Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, word that Taliban leader Mullah Omar is dead. Discussion of the proposed safe zone along the Turkey-Syria border. How will the internet generation fit into the workforce?
We are looking at this generation as kind of the reality check generation.
And a new song from the boxing film Southpaw. It's coming up on The Voice of America. Afghan government officials have confirmed that reclusive Taliban chief Mullah Omar is dead. Joining us on the line from Islamabad is correspondent Ayaz Gul. Welcome, Ayaz.
Hi, welcome.
Hi. What do we know about all this?
It has been really a dramatic day in this region. It started with some media reports that quoted senior Afghan officials that Mullah Omar is dead, the leader of the Taliban. And then later on, the Taliban spoke when VOA contacted the Taliban, they denied those reports and they said he's very much alive and that he's leading the fight in Afghanistan. So after all those reports, there was a presidential presser in Kabul, and the Afghan president's spokesman also, when he was posed this question whether the government knows that Mullah Omar is dead, he said the government is still trying to assess those reports. And then that's it. He would not confirm or deny whether Mullah Omar is dead. Now, later on in the evening, the Afghan intelligence agency's spokesman told media that that it is now confirmed that Mullah Omar is dead. But until then, things were still volatile and there was confusion surrounding this whole affair. Just a little while ago, like a few minutes ago, Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani's office now issued a brief statement in which it has now confirmed, according to their credible information, as it says, that Mullah Omar died in 2013 in a Pakistani hospital. So we have from Afghan officials and the president's office that Mullah Omar is dead, but as of this moment, the Taliban insists that their leader, that its leader is still alive.
Could this purported death complicate the second round of peace talks, which are set to begin Friday between the Taliban and the Afghan government?
Well, obviously, this is a big blow. If these reports are true, and if the Taliban at any point in time after this presidential statement also confirms that its leader is dead, then this is going to damage the entire peace process that has just been started like maybe 3 weeks ago. And this second round of negotiations, which was due in Pakistan and which is, as of this moment, confirmed to take place near Islamabad on Friday. Sources close to this whole process here in Islamabad say that if Mullah Omar's, the reports of Mullah Omar's death are true, then there will be the purpose of these negotiations will also be dead, because on the table, whichever Taliban leaders will be sitting talking to the Afghan delegation will have no unified leadership after Mullah Omar's death, and it could really lead to serious disintegration within the Taliban ranks, and there could be a serious infighting for who is going to lead the Islamic movement after the death of Mullah Omar. So with all this chaotic situation, if it is confirmed finally by the Taliban that that Mullah Omar is dead, the purpose of, this next round of negotiations, apparently according to sources here who are engaged in the organization of these negotiations, will be useless this next round.
Do we know why all this news is coming out now?
Well, that's the question everybody is raising, that if the Afghan intelligence knew that Mullah Omar died 2 years ago in Pakistan, why were they sitting on this information for 2 years and waiting for a moment when there's a lot of hope in the region that as a result of this nascent Afghan peace process, there could be peace in Afghanistan? And the importance of these negotiations could be gauged from the fact that Chinese and American officials are also sitting as observers on the table when the two sides are negotiating. And for this round of negotiation, which is due on Friday, American and Chinese observers are also coming to participate. And as Daniel Feldman, the special representative, the special U.S. representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he was in Islamabad today and he spoke to a group of reporters. And he was quite hopeful that this process where the U.S. officials will be sitting as observers could lead to peace in Afghanistan. So there was a lot of hope and optimism that this Afghan peace process could lead to end of hostilities in Afghanistan. But with this news of the Taliban's leader, Mullah Omar, being dead, obviously it's a major setback for this whole effort in which Pakistan, the United States, China, and other allies of Afghanistan are playing a role to promote peace in Afghanistan. I mean, this process will seriously suffer if the Taliban now confirms that Mullah Omar is dead.
Well, thank you very much, Ayaz, for speaking with us from Islamabad today.
Thank you, Susan.
The reported death of the Taliban leader is starting to get more attention on Twitter, and Michael Lippin is here in the studio to tell us more about that. Michael.
Hi, Susan. Thank you. Yes, the Topsy Analytics website shows that the hashtag Mullah Omar has been used at least 5,000 times in the past day. And the news already has triggered strong reactions from Pakistan, where Afghan authorities say the Taliban leader died. One tweet getting noticed is from a columnist for the Daily Times newspaper, Mohammed Taqi. His handle is @Mazdaki, and he has 35,000 followers. This is what he wrote. Hashtag Mullah Omar was a ruthless butcher who unleashed a bloodbath on Afghans upon Pakistan's behest. Rot in hell, Mullah Saib. Hashtag good riddance. So clearly some Pakistanis are happy to hear about the reported demise of Mullah Omar. But you know, other Pakistanis are upset, perhaps because of what Ayaz was saying earlier about fears that the news could disrupt Pakistani-mediated peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. One prominent Pakistani rights activist, Ahmed Qureshi, believes India is behind the reports. Qureshi's handle is @AQPK, and he's got 87,000 Twitter followers. And this is what he said. Hashtag India floated Mullah Omar death story to disturb Pakistan-sponsored Kabul-Afghan-Taliban talks. So we'll have to see how India responds to that conspiracy theory. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
If you've ever tried to lose weight, you know how hard it can be and harder yet to keep off. A new study confirms that. British researchers tracked the weight of nearly 280,000 people over a 10-year period and found the chances of an obese person attaining a normal body weight are very low. According to the study, of those considered obese, with a body mass index of 30 to 35, only 1 in 210 men and 1 in 124 women were able to drop enough weight to be considered normal weight. To make matters worse, the research also finds that about half of those studied that did lose weight gained it back within 2 years. More than three quarters of them had regained the weight within 5 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Says it has secured an agreement with the Obama administration to jointly secure a zone in a small part of northern Syria. According to both American and Turkish officials, coalition airstrikes will aim to drive Islamic extremists out of the zone, allowing the targeted area to come under the sway of rebel groups seeking to topple President Bashar al-Assad. U.S. officials briefing reporters in Washington stepped back from describing the proposed boundaries as a safe zone, saying the goal is to establish an ISIL-free zone and ensure greater security and stability along Turkey's border with Syria. My colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi has been investigating this story and joins me now in the studio.
I followed a discussion about that safe zone at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center with Francis Ricciardoni, former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, and Ambassador Frederick Hoff, a senior fellow at the center focusing on Syria. According to Ambassador Hoff, Washington and Ankara have agreed, at least in principle, to protect a certain zone in northern Syria. What may also be in play is a passive understanding between the two sides that the creation of this safe zone and an accompanying aerial exclusion zone would have the effect of sharply reducing the barrel bombing of Syrian civilians by Assad regime air force. Obviously, the United States would take the lead in keeping non-coalition air assets out of that safe zone. The Syria expert specified the objectives of establishing such a safe zone.
The stated purpose of the initiative is to exclude ISIS from the Turkey-Syria border along this 68-mile stretch and from a protected zone or a safe zone, dimensions yet to be decided inside Syria. Within this safe zone, nationalist Syrian rebels being trained and equipped to fight ISIS would be protected by coalition aircraft, perhaps supplemented by Turkish artillery.
Ambassador Hoff said also it appears that Turkey may see this agreement as a way to water down or at least mitigate Washington's current dependence on the Kurdish fighters in Syria to provide ground forces to fight ISIS.
But what prompted Turkey to change its policy and actively join the fight against the Islamic State?
U.S. former ambassador to Turkey Francis Ricciardoni said Turkey realized at last that a Syrian civil war spillover into Turkey, Islamic State advancing to its borders, and Kurdish scheme for an independent Kurdish state all created a sense of a threat to Turkey's national security.
ISIS certainly has made a strategic mistake, repeating recently the first mistake it made a year ago when it took Turkish diplomats hostage, setting up a course of antagonism that was papered over for a while. And now finally won the enmity of the Turkish state, which is a serious state with a serious national security apparatus, not only military but also intelligence and law enforcement. Just as PKK has made a mistake, I think, in the political process, albeit they may have done so in response to political pressures from the Turkish government itself.
Ricciardoni said what is also behind this is a lot of powerful political dynamics within Turkey following the elections. All of that plays into the government's national security decisions on what to do about the PKK, for one, and then how to deal with the other Kurds in the region, how to work with the Kurds in Syria, in particular, in this case.
Well, I wonder, Mohammed, would the creation of the safe zone in northern Syria represent a prelude to establishing a Syrian interim government as a precursor to a political settlement in Syria?
While the United Nations is still keeping the hope alive by offering a potential Geneva III conference, Ambassador Hoff has a different assessment of the chances of any political solution in Syria.
My sense is that any prospect at all of a negotiated political settlement is zero as long as these daily outrages, these daily atrocities, these daily abominations are taking place.
Well, Mohammed, thank you for this review. It sounds like it was an important discussion over there at the Hariri Center for the Middle East.
Yeah, it was. Thank you for having me.
The first U.S. internet generation is preparing to enter the workforce, but what will they be like? A new study co-conducted by Robert Half explores this question. The district president, Billy Watkins, joins us on the line from New York. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, what do you expect from these young people?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You know, we are looking at this generation as kind of the reality check generation. And, you know, some of our findings were interesting in that they tend to have a more traditional approach than maybe, you know, an outlook in terms of their, you know, launching their career and what they expect as they do that. Then maybe, you know, their generation before them, Generation Y. I think something that was very surprising was that a good number of them, 77%, indicated that they plan to work harder than their predecessors in order to have a successful career. It wasn't that that was a negative. It, you know, some of the results indicate there's a lot of drive in this generation and looking forward to it, but they're realists, and they expect to, you know, potentially have to work longer as well. Whereas they like to retire in the 60s, most are anticipating they may have to work until a minimum 70 years old before they have what they need to actually, you know, successfully retire. So I thought it was really interesting, the pragmatic approach that this generation seems to be taking.
What about the influence of social media in their lives? They've been around it forever.
Right. And so if you think about it, this generation has only known an internet-based kind of environment. Many probably don't remember life without a smartphone, unlike myself. And so everything that they're about is about social media, you know, access to technology to navigate their careers and, frankly, just navigate their lives. So I think when you're looking at how to connect with this group of potential employees, you have to be realistic about utilizing social media, social networking to gain kind of some interest in their candidacy and connecting with them in a real way so they see value in what you're offering.
Why do you think they're so pragmatic about the future?
Well, if you think about how their exposure, you know, they have been raised in a pretty turbulent economic environment. So they've seen an economic recession, and honestly, it's probably provided a realistic view of what they should expect. They've seen their grandparents maybe have to go back to work or, you know, pick up part-time jobs to frankly, survive. And their parents may be utilizing savings that they thought they may be able to put away for a while to retire early. And so no bad or good necessarily, but just more of a realistic approach to what I need to do to prepare myself for my future and prepare myself for retirement when I can.
Do you think this is going to make for a stronger workforce down the line?
You know, I think having a realistic view on what you should offer and can offer, being driven to succeed, but also being positive about it, certainly helps, right? You know, there are a number of generations that will current, as this generation continues to enter the workforce, and you see about 30 million baby boomers, I think, projected to leave the workforce in 2020, there'll be a lot of generational diversity. So it certainly doesn't help hurt to have a pragmatic approach with kind of the newest employees entering the workforce first. But, you know, I think the diversity that we see across the spectrum also allows us to modify our environment so that we're speaking to all and delivering the best services as corporations.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're tuned to VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Smoking cigarettes is a well-known health hazard and mortality risk. Disease such as Ebola can also radically shorten lifespan. But researchers at the University of Cambridge have released a new study about the impact of having multiple chronic conditions. They find that having more than one of the so-called cardiometabolic conditions, stroke, heart attack, or type 2 diabetes, does not bode well for long life. Their startling conclusion: having two of these conditions by age 60 reduced life expectancy by some 12 years in men and 13 years for women. This was a shorter life expectancy than even that of lifelong smokers. The researchers say their findings highlight the importance of heart disease and stroke prevention for diabetes patients. Health professionals say that healthy lifestyle habits can improve heart and overall health. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Rapper Eminem's teams with No Doubt's Gwen Stefani for a new song from the boxing film Southpaw. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Border Crossing's host Larry London about Kings Never Die.
You might be a fan of his from The Slim Shady or other songs that he's put on the radio, but Eminem has got a new one out, and he teams up with Gwen Stefani from No Doubt for Kings Never Die. Larry, this is from the soundtrack for the new 50 Cent produced movie Southpaw, right?
That's right. It's one of those boxing films. I saw the movie, and it ain't no Rocky, that's for sure.
Well, it's Jake Gyllenhaal,
Jake Gyllenhaal is in the film. And by the way, Eminem was up for the same role, but he turned it down. In fact, he was negotiating to play the lead role,
right,
as the boxer whose name is Billy Hope in the film, but
right,
he said no, eventually deciding against it. So, yes, Jake Gyllenhaal, Rachel McAdams, 50 Cent, who's in the film.
And this song is a, it's, you know, it's kind of one of those angry rap anthem, get your blood up. It'd be great to work out to. It'd be, well, a great workout song.
Eminem's got three songs on the soundtrack. And by the way, as a side note, this film was scored by James Horner, who passed away in June.
Right, the guy who did Titanic.
That's right. This is his last film that he put music in, and the end, they say in memory of James Horner.
I can hear the drummer drumming. In the trumpet, someone's trying to summon someone. I know something's coming. But I'm running from it to be standing at the summit and plummet. How come it wasn't what I thought it was? Was it too good to be true? Have nothing, get it all, but too much of it. Then lose it again. Did I swallow hallucinogens? Cause if not, where the hell did it go? Cause here I sit in Lucifer's den by the touch of and just choosing to sin. Even if it means I'm selling my soul just to be the undisputed again.
This particular song that Eminem and Gwen Stefani perform doesn't appear until you're two-thirds of the way through the film. It's right near the end with the big fight, which I'm not going to reveal too much about, but the big fight that comes at the end. And you hear this song playing. And when you hear it in the film, you don't really hear much Gwen Stefani. But when you hear the song itself, she's featured in the song. You can tell it's her.
Now, this is not a big departure for Eminem because he's, you know, kind of in your face. But Gwen Stefani is more kind of mellow type thing. So this is a little... Is she branching out with this tune?
Well, I can't necessarily say that, but she has been working on a new solo album. She's slow on the project. She's been working with Pharrell. We don't have a date. We don't have a title. We know very little about it. I know that she's doing some shows with No Doubt, and she's also going to be coaching on The Voice, replacing Christina Aguilera here in the U.S.
Okay, well, that's VOA's Larry London. You can hit him up on Twitter. That's at VOA underscore music. You can also watch his show, which is Border Crossings. That's on our website, www.voanews.com. If you want to send us a tweet, we're at VOA underscore IE. And if you want to send one to me, I'm at David underscore D Bird.
And don't forget about our website at voanews.com. You can go there and listen to our program anytime you want under the Programs tab. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist six rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yaw Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jok Riak, and Major General Santino Deng Wal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All six had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.